And we had just finished saying that in this world your joy is not full. Christmas time, the time of joy and so forth. But plenty of reason for believing that we haven't even made a good start at that. Therefore, now the next verse, 37, reaches an interesting conclusion, since your joy isn't full. Wherefore, care not for the body, neither for the life of the body. Well, that seems very unrealistic. What about hygiene? What about the word of wisdom? What about things like that? Well, it goes on. Always remember, always read the rest of it in the Doctrine and Covenants. But care for the soul and the life of the soul. It's the part you're thinking, the whole you're thinking of, not the part. Part is just one, of course, we're told. The spirit and the body are the soul of man, or is the soul of man. It's the soul you have to think of. Of course, and what is the idea of the word of wisdom? What's the main purpose of the word of wisdom? For health and strength, wisdom and great treasures, even hidden treasures. See, it is the state of mind that's the primary thing. That is the important thing. We read about centenarians who were asked, what's the secret of your long life? And half the time they'll say, I was abstemious, I never touched tea or coffee, tobacco, and so forth. The other half will say, well, I had the cigar and the pint of liquor every day. But different, one lived to be 100 on that diet, another on another. That isn't the object. That is not the object. Care not. It's not the body or the life of the body that we're caring about, because that's not going to go on forever, no matter what. But it is the soul and the life of the soul. The spirit and the body united, and you're thinking of the resurrection, and that's what you're aiming at. The whole and not the parts. And seek the face of the Lord always, that in patience you may contain yourself. Now, what is the meaning of that? Seek the face of the Lord always. What is your ultimate objective? What are you moving toward? Remember, to be in his presence, to see him. And you keep that constantly in mind. You're constantly moving toward that objective at all times. We're in the process of seeking, no matter how distant, the next verse is going to tell us, no matter how distant our objective is, you must keep that objective in mind all the time. You break your project up into little local projects. You do this and do this and do this, but always with the object of reaching the other one. And you never lose sight of the other one, or else there'll be no proportion. The local project ceases to have meaning unless you always keep the big one in mind. Of course, this is what is lacking in modern civilization. Of course, we live from day to day. We don't really believe that we're going to live forever or anything like that. And so we feel harassed, and we feel very unsatisfactory, unfulfilled, as they say, and so forth. And they say, well, you just live this day. Again, this is the philosophy of the Epicureans. You just live for today, and that will be enough. But it is not enough. All right, I'm going to live just for today. But what will I do then just for today? That's fine, so here you are. You're going to live for today. All right, what are you going to do? You're going to get drunk. More fun getting drunk than not. Yeah, but what about tomorrow? I have an awful hangover. Oh, you're not living just for today after all. And you can't do it. You can't live for today, because immediately you say, well, now what am I going to do? If you know what you're doing, of course, this is the beauty of the gospel. It tells us what we have to do at all times, why we have to do it. And this is very important. Otherwise, you're lost. See? It's a play without a plot. It's an interesting thing. We have, you might think, two scenarios. We have the scientific picture of the world as we have it. I've been going into a lot of this stuff. It's very interesting. Popular works and other kinds, giving us the picture of the background of the human race, what science discovered about this, that, and the other, going from the moons of Jupiter down to excavations in the Near East or something like that. But what have you got there? You say, now, here is a picture of the human race, and here is another picture that the gospel gives us. We have these two scenarios. Aha! And they're not the same. The picture science gives us is not the same as the picture of the human race, its background, its future, its real nature. It's not the same as that which science gives us at the present time. You say, which do you prefer? Well, the joke is there are not two scenarios at all. The science has absolutely nothing to offer in the way of a scenario or explanation. As Einstein said, science does not explain, it merely describes. That's all you can do. The same thing. Newton is a good example of that. We don't want to get hung up on this. Newton explained the laws of Newton, which explains what goes on among bodies out in space. But, as Newton himself often said, as to why it happens, the explanation for it, that's a complete mystery. He says that lies entirely with God. We don't know what it is that makes bodies attract each other the way they do. or act the way they do. Science explains nothing, as Einstein says. It merely describes. It describes what happens. Well, the gospel, so there is no competition. See, it merely describes the properties of the plate. Put it this way. What do? You analyze everything about you, everything you can see, feel, and touch. All this is subject to analysis, and you explain the way one thing influences another in a limited system, but you look at everything around you, and you are merely describing it. And you're describing the stage. You're describing the paint. You're describing the actors. You may even go into their psychology. You describe the drops, the sets, the background, the lighting, and everything else. But there's no play. There's no plot. The minute you say, well, now, what's behind this all, then you're not being scientific. You don't ask that. You just describe what you have before you. And so it's a stage without a play. It's a stage without a plot. It just comes to be. And that, we find, is an intolerable situation. Well, anyway, so it tells us here, we seek the face of the Lord always. And then we have some object or purpose. That in patience, the rest of the verse, you may possess your souls. Since we know the goal, then, and since we're a long, long way from it, in what mood do we carry on? We possess our souls in patience. We don't despair, we don't give up, we're not worried about anything. Everything is fine because we're seeking the face of the Lord. We know the direction we're moving in, and we can afford to wait. We can afford to wait, possess our souls in patience because we have the assurance it is there and that we are moving in that direction. Again, as we say before, where you are isn't very important. The Lord knows where you are, and you know where you are as far as that goes. But the direction you're going, that's what makes the difference. The person on the top step facing down is much worse off than the person on the bottom step facing up. It's the direction you're going that makes all the difference. And so we possess our souls in patience because we seek the face of the Lord always, and that's the way we sail with a steady keel. We don't lose control or anything. And ye shall have eternal life. What is this rough, brief passage then to what awaits us on the other side? Now, moving amidst our temporal society, the next verse, the 39th. Our beings of eternal, this is an interesting thing. This has something to do with the knowledge of the ancients and so forth. There are really two types of being on the world. Moving in our world, there are, of course, it's the subject of numerous science fiction stories and so forth, the unrecognized alien from outer space or whatever it may be, moving amongst us, being with us, and we don't recognize who it is. The Indians have the idea that there are kings and queens among us. We don't recognize them because they wear their crowns covered with hair, with a knot, top knot of hair on the top, covering their crowns. We don't recognize them, but recognition of them is a real test of us. But the way it puts it here, when men are called to the everlasting gospel and covenant, with an everlasting covenant, they are accounted as the salt of the earth and the savor of men. See, among all the millions that swarm, and billions that swarm upon the earth, there are some who are very special. They're the salt, they're of the savor. They lead spice, they lead meaning, as we said before. It's the plot to the play. Once you get your beautiful, magnificent set all set up, and you have your superb special effects and so forth, then everything depends on whether you have a play or not, whether you really have a story, whether you really have something going on. But, you know, there's many a play that tries to get by on the special effects.
Star Trek,
that was good, because the effects were good and so forth, but everyone that's copied it has fallen flat since. See, because the idea, they didn't have anything really to tell. Nothing much to report. So there are people that are called to the everlasting gospel, and they are not like other people. Notice, they are counted as the salt of the earth and the savor of men. And you know what salt and savor does here. The scriptures talk about this too. There are many have entertained angels unaware that there are such moving, these alien beings, the king in disguise and so forth. Those with an everlasting calling and an everlasting covenant are what save the world from desolation. These are what the Jews call the tzaddik in the early Jewish literature, especially in the Kabbalistic, the mystical literature, the tzaddik, the righteous man. The righteous man who is quite different from anyone else. A tzaddik is somebody who is not like the rest. He has certain signs, there's certain ways you can recognize him. And of course, in Jewish mysticism, there's a lot said about those. If a person frowns, he has three marks above between his brows. That's the sheen. that's a sign that he's blessed. Or if he has the Star of David in his hand. They were always looking for the signs by which they could recognize a tzaddik, a special person. And those who've been properly instructed will be able to recognize. Well, this idea that there is in the earth another, a special type of being. The point, what it tells us here, is those who have accepted the gospel are such people. They're not like the rest of the world. They shouldn't be. They can't be. Because they are... So how are they to serve? Are they just aliens? If they're aliens, how can they... They're like strangers and pilgrims in the earth. Here we are strangers and pilgrims. Here we have no abiding home. Pilgrim goes to in Pilgrim's Progress, Pilgrim visits the earth, which is Vanity Fair. As Pilgrim passes through Vanity Fair, he's really taken for everything he's got. All these operators here really clean him out, because this is the way an honest person is treated in this world. Everybody's out for all they can grab, and poor Pilgrim has an awful time, you know. But nevertheless, it doesn't bother him, because he's an alien. He is looking for his heavenly city. Remember, he's taking the journey to his celestial city, his Pilgrim. And none of these things bother him. He's detained, he's thrown into jail, and so forth and so on. But this is not here his home, as Paul says. Here we have no abiding kingdom. What is that poem? Is it Hilda? Yes. In Thomas Hartley Peter, from Yale, Bergen. I was thinking of a poem that goes this way. It's Helderman, all right. Zach was an Heimat. Yes. Heute im Traum sei ich sie wieder. And das ist unto violently. Well, anyway, where is my real home? I dreamed about it last night, and when I woke up, I could only cry, because I realized I hadn't got there yet, but at least I have one, and so forth. Well, this idea of the aloofness of the saints from the world, this is expressed rather clearly here, but Pilgrim, as he goes through, has a purpose. Without him, there would be no story. The whole thing would be flat. If there wasn't poor Pilgrim to take advantage of and fleece and knock around, what would the rest of the people do? They just play dirty tricks on each other, and that's no particular fun, you see. There'd be nothing would be happening. Unless somebody's willing to keep the rules, nobody can profit by breaking them. And, of course, we are today drawing increasingly heavy drafts on an increasingly dwindling resource or capital of virtue here. So we reach the point where everybody's doing everybody else, and then what happens? Then you're back to the conditions that Isaiah describes. So here, those with an everlasting calling, we're told here, and an everlasting covenant, are what save the world from desolation. That is the tzaddik, for whose sake the earth was created. He even says that here, because it's very interesting, you see. This we're told about Abraham. Abraham was the tzaddik for whose sake the earth was created. If that hadn't been for Abraham, if it wasn't for this rare, just person, God never would have bothered to create the earth, as Zohar says. And they're the salt, they're the savor. They give the taste to life. The word enoch means both taste and touch and instruction and guidance and light. It means all sorts of things. That's our friend Enoch. Without Enoch, the world would have been nothing, they tell us. But seasoning is something special. And if it isn't something special, if the salt doesn't have any savor, or if the season doesn't have any taste, what good is it? It's not a staple diet, it's not basic, it's not full of calories, it's not for the sake of its nourishment that you eat it at all. If it doesn't have savor, it's nothing, and that's what the saints are. If they're not different, they're nothing. They can't be just like ordinary food. I mean, if you eat your salt and your cinnamon and your spice and so forth, and it's lost all its flavor completely, but you say, well, I'm just eating this as good nourishing food. It's not good nourishing food. It cannot serve. The saints must be different, or it's a complete waste. They're not ordinary fare. The 40th verse tells us, salt and spices without savor have no food value whatever. They're less than the stuff they season. The Latter-day Saint who does not perform a special function in the world is a drag and a pestilential nuisance. No business being there at all. Because all we do is throw things out of gear and make people unhappy and so forth. Unless we have a darn good reason for it. They're doing more harm than good. And many of the Latter-day Saints have fallen flat and must be chastened. The 41st verse, behold, here is wisdom concerning the children of Zion. Even many, but not all, they were found transgressors, therefore they must needs be chastened. And don't try to push yourself just because you're that way. The 42nd verse here. The seasoning doesn't try to take over the meal. A thing that is over-seasoned is less desirable even than a thing that has no seasoning at all. Don't overdo it. Don't try to be the whole show. you should it should abase itself. What's the purpose of seasoning? See, it's to take a back seat. You're not even, it's unobtrusive. You're not even aware. You say it's delicious, but you don't know why. Only a very skilled person, the Nero Wolf, can distinguish just what is being used to season this particular dish. You don't really know what it is. It doesn't put itself forward to say, aha, this is thyme, or this is basil. Very strong. It knocks you down. Well, that's not the purpose of seasoning. It's the food that's the important thing here, and it's the same thing. It's the saints, he that exalteth himself shall be abased, and he that abaseth himself shall be exalted. In this connection of being the salt of the earth. Do your work without advertising yourself. Make the fare delicious without being too obvious. And then a parable follows. It's about the olive and the vine. Now the olive and the vine together, that's this stock Mediterranean fare. The two always grow together. Ovid's famous ode on the olive and the vine. They're very Mediterranean, very scriptural. The important thing, actually, was to destroy the olive trees, the 45th verse here. Let's move on. They set watchmen around because... Anciently, what did you try to do? Destroy the olive trees, because people lived from olives. It was their nourishment, it was their cooking, it was their soap. Everything they had depended on the olive tree. And the marvelous thing about the olive tree, you can cut it right down till there's nothing but a stump, you know, and then it'll grow up again. And their olives, thousands of years old, still grow. The shoots always come out, most miraculously. So the first thing an enemy did was really to try to wreck the olive tree. Anything they could do, and they were very thorough at it. So they set the watchman about. You must set the watchman about for the sake of the good old olives. And steal the grapes. Of course, they would wreck the olive tree and steal the grapes. This, again, we have all sorts of parables about fables and things like that. Well, why build a watchtower in time of peace? He builds this thing. Well, they have a surprise attack. By night against that, but they quarrel about it, and they neglect the work in the 50th verse. You're going faster. While they were at variance with one another, they became very slothful. They hearkened not unto the commands of the Lord. That's what's happening in the church. And the result was a surprise attack by night. Typically, you know why they were building it. They started asking questions. Should we do this, and should we do this, and why should we do this? Remember, this is a parable. It's an analogy. And a parable is usually used to emphasize just one point. For example, when the Lord tells us, he compares his heavenly Father with a cruel and unjust master, who absolutely, in one respect, the Lord demands that certain conditions be met. He says so before he can receive certain ones. In certain regards, we mustn't take these parables as telling us to go and do likewise, but they're to illustrate a particular point, and here it's this. Well, the Lord gathered his forces and reoccupies. He says, I have bought it with money. Now that's a good example. Is this a pitch for the real estate business? No, you buy things with money. There's a lot said about, more said about this in this section on this. The saints are to buy the land with money too. The purpose of doing that is to be quit of the world. You don't, in an article here some years ago, this concept. In rendering to Caesar that which is Caesar's, the early Christian was not recognizing divine sovereignty, but buying his way out. That's what you do with money. A sharp distinction was made between paying Caesar tax money that was his. He has it coming. This is much of it. He has his tenth. There's no question of excessive taxation, since what Caesar owns is the whole earth, the orbis terrarum. He is the lord of this world. So he has a right to tax, and you pay him so that you would be quit with him, so he'll have nothing against you, have no legal case against you at all. You will be in the clear. You must make this concession, and these saints always made it. The Prince of Incense, for example, was an acknowledgement of divinity, and they wouldn't give him that. That's easy enough. A good Christian died sooner than make the concession, while the former was merely a recognition of ownership. And they paid tax. Of course, the Christmas story in Luke begins with going to be taxed, each one going to his place. And Joseph and his family went. The early Christians were urged to make friends with the mammon of unrighteousness as the best way to be rid of him, paying quickly and gladly whatever fees the master of the earth imposed on them. Now we find this in, they were to pay taxes, we turn in Luke 20, they were to allow themselves to be exploited rather than become involved in litigation, Matthew 5 and 25. They were to play the world's game just enough to allay suspicion, Luke 16 and so forth. They gladly conceded the rich man's right to his worldly possessions, since they claimed only the heavenly ones, as they called in Luke 16. You deal with the world on its terms. It must out and have no case against you. You must be in the clear. Then they went their way, resolutely refusing to own lands or houses or of their own, which they felt would encumber them with worldly obligations and vitiate their status as strangers and pilgrims. But this is the way they always did it. They paid their way and were willing, even if they were overcharged terribly, all right. Anything not to be dragged into court and so forth. But anyway, he tells us here, now he orders his people to smash the appointments of the occupying force, says, avenge me of mine enemies until I come and take over again. The servants say, when will that be? The master says, never mind when that'll be, just do it. In the 61st verse, I will reward you well and put you in charge. And the job finally was done after many days. The moral in the 63rd verse is, don't question everything. The point of the parable is not that we should plant olive trees and build walls and towers to protect them or go out and make a gaza, a raid against our enemies. Incidentally, our word raid is an Arabic word. It means going and spoiling your enemies. It's your vendetta, your jihad, your vengeance on the neighboring tribe, and everybody's always making a gaza. The Arabs have a saying, as long as we live, we shall make a gaza. The nature of life is to raid your enemy's ground, because that's a sign of nobility, and you might gain something that way. And moreover, he's done the same thing to you, so you have to do the same thing to him. You're under sacred obligation to hit back. And this is the way they've lived for thousands of years. Just try to reason with such people. Well, the point is not that we should practice this economy. The purpose of a parable, I say, is to illustrate usually one particular point, not to recommend a way of life, I say. In the New Testament, the Lord is compared with a cruel despot, the builder of a tower. He's compelled with a thief in the night. The Lord says, I come, his coming will be as a thief in the night. Aha, he's recommending that people go out and rob things, steal things. That's not it at all. The thief comes, he surprises everyone off guard, nobody suspecting him, he doesn't tell you when he's come, he catches you unawares. That's the thing the Lord wants to emphasize when he says that he will return as a thief in the night. Not that he comes to rob or plunder, that he's recommending that to other people. See, you can do this. People take parables and think that justifies them. The building of the tower. Who sits down and takes thought when he builds a tower? Well, that shows that we should engage in this sort of thing. The Lord ends that parable. We never conclude. Therefore, take no thought. What he's telling them is you're very shrewd about your earthly affairs. The really important ones you neglect entirely. Aren't you ashamed of yourselves? He is rebuking them for sitting down and taking thought about building the tower. Not the other way around. Well, the foolish virgins. Is it foolish to be a virgin? Let's go out and have some fun then. Because the virgins were foolish. They weren't foolish in that regard because they were virgins. That had nothing to do with it. They were foolish because they didn't show good sense. They burned up all the oil in their lamps, you see. But you can do this. You can twist the scriptures around that way and justify all sorts of things, and we do it a good deal. Well, such an operation as the gathering requires those qualities of zeal, action, trust, and obedience, we're told in the 64th verse, that the work of the gathering together of my saints continue, that I may build them up to name unto my name upon holy places, for the time of the harvest is come, and my word must needs be fulfilled. Another parable, 65 following, the wheat and the tares. Again, this doesn't all mean that we should be all field workers. The tares make a division among the people, and the gathering of wheat into barns. You notice we interpret this, the Christian world interprets this differently. This is the famous parable of the wheat and the tares is one of the few that the Lord himself explained the meaning of, what he's talking about. And we say, though in the kingdom here below the wheat and tares together grow, in the church the wheat and tares grow together. He's not talking about the church at all. The Lord says the church, the field, the Lord said to the apostle, is the world. He says in three of the Gospels, the field is the world. It's not the church. And when the time comes, he's talking about the apostasy. And when the Lord comes again, then he says the time will come to gather the wheat together and make a separation. Some will be gathered together to the barn, and that's the church, he says. And the other will be left and gathered together for the burning. That's it, when the separation comes. It's not within the church, but the division that he's talking about. The field is the world, and when I come again, he says, when the Lord comes again, then will be the gathering in of the sheaves and the separation of the wheat and the tares, which is supposed to be what happens now. The gathering, he tells us in the 68th verse, must be methodical and organized. and we must remove all legal obstacles by clear purchase of the land, especially in the Jackson County area. And what you cannot purchase, he says, leave that to me. But collect all the money you have for it. Use everything you have now to get a claim to this land. He will use it later. Put competent men in charge of the negotiations. It doesn't have to be, he says in the 74th verse, it doesn't have to be in Jackson County. Those living in the East may buy lands and gather together upon them, he says. He never was insisting on just one place here. That is where they are. Those who are down and out must continue to seek legitimate redress. Whether they get it or not, they must seek it for the record, to show they have the claim. Notice the 76th there. I say unto you, those who have been scattered by their enemies, it's my will that they should continue to importune for redress and redemption by the hands of those who are placed as rulers in authority over you. We must never let up on that, because it must be for the record. We must clear our position in the world. And on their terms. We settle with the world on their terms, not on ours. And then comes the section on the Constitution here. The Constitution of the people which I have suffered to be established. It's their Constitution, but I allow it. Suffered, he uses this word again, he's going to use it in a very strong sense later on. I have suffered them. It's their own operation, and I have allowed it and permitted it, and I have blessed them with very competent men to do it. To be maintained for what purpose? For the rights and protection of all flesh. This is not a partisan document. All flesh doesn't mean just the good guys. The worst criminal has rights and protections under the Constitution, doesn't he? We sometimes think that's outrageous. But as Oliver Wendell Holmes says, the freedom is freedom for the lie we hate as much as for the truth we love. He has to be, they have to have their day in court, they have to have their hearing. And the civil rights of all flesh must rest on just and holy principles. Nothing less than the inalienable principle of free agency you've talked about here. But it's for the rights and protection of all flesh. That covers a lot of ground, you see. Not just for those people who have worked hard and who are respectful members of society and so forth and whom we accept, but for the rights and protection of all flesh. Now, how the rights and protection of all flesh here? They make it by making it possible that every man may act according to the moral agency which I have given unto him. Every man. All actions being undertaken in doctrine, that is a reasoned explanation, doctrine, and in principle, basic premise for action, pertaining to futurity. Again, we're back to that again. We're not doctrine and principle. We're not automatons or John Watson's organisms reacting to an environment. See, in behaviorism, all person is an organism reacting to an environment, and that's all. That's the whole story, whether it's with John Watson or John Dewey or whoever it is. That used to be, it still is the basis of psychological teaching today. Whereas William James defines intelligence as the ability to react to absent stimulus. The more intelligent you are, the more you can react to an absent stimulus, something isn't there. See, an immediate stimulus, if I touch somebody with something with a hot wire and it jerks, that doesn't take any great intelligence. An amoeba will do that. The more immediate the stimulus, the less intelligent it takes to react to it. But when you react to something in the infinite future, or to the idea of eternal life, that takes real intelligence, as far as that goes. William James, a famous definition of intelligence, the ability to react to an absent stimulus. It isn't there. That requires not only imagination, but it takes quite a number of other qualities, but they add up to intelligence, he says. Well, that is acting pertaining, your actions pertain to futurity. That means you have plans, you have intentions, and your moral agency, what you do, makes sense with relationship to what your objective is, what that futurity is. Our actions are conditioned by more than immediate stimulus. We are, as we say, participants in a drama, in a scenario, and all our actions pertain to futurity. This is what the Jews call the acharit, the latter end. After all, it says, when can you decide whether an act is good or bad? When can you decide whether you have been wise or foolish in your actions? When can you decide, etc., etc.? The acharit. Always look to the acharit, meaning the latter end. Translation, of course, in the King James Version is the latter end. But it means, the Egyptians have a better expression, they say ergeret. Till you reach the last border as far as you can imagine, and then go beyond that. is as far as you, the aphorite is the ultimate goal, the final object, the latter end, the end that comes after everything else. That is the thing by which we judge our actions. So it's talking here about our moral agency, immediate moral agency. See, if there is no latter end, if, as Korihor says, when the man dies, that is the end thereof, therefore they lifted their heads and rejoiced, they had no moral agency, no moral obligation, whatever. Whatsoever a man did, it was no sin, because when the man died, that was the end thereof. It's called in Alma 30, you know, yesterday. And that's perfectly true. That's the philosophy that's the philosophy of the world, as a matter of fact. Under no moral obligation, if you don't believe there is an aphorite, it's going to be the end here. There'll be no judgment. There'll be no responsibility. There'll be no remorse. There'll be no awareness. There'll be no nothing. So, what can you lose? Do anything you want. Remember, God is dead. As Lenin says, God is dead, all is permitted. This was the philosophy there. The revolution of 1917, that was one of the slogans. God is dead, all is permitted. But this, notice this, that every man may be accountable for his own sins in the day of judgment. Now that's futurity. He's looking forward to the day of judgment when every man will be accountable for his own sins. If he's under the pressure, if he's not free, how is this? He's not to be accountable for what we do. As the Greeks say, not to be held accountable is not a blessing, it's not a release, it's a supreme insult. As Plato says, if I have done wrong, I want to be punished. If you tell me, well, he's not responsible, he's non compos mentis, he's not very bright, it doesn't make any, let him go, we won't hold anything against him, we'll never hold him accountable. Well, he says, that is a supreme insult, to be treated as something that can't be held responsible for what he does, morally or otherwise. So we want to be held responsible. Every man wants to be held accountable for his own sins in the day of judgment. Well, what could hinder a man from being responsible for his own moral agency? The answer is this. Perhaps you're in bondage to someone. The next verse, 79. Therefore, it is not right that any man should be in bondage to another. If you're in bondage, then are you completely responsible for what you do? You have to do what he tells you to do. Of course, no, you don't. Yeah, this is the whole work of Solzhenitsyn, has shown that. When you get a situation in which everyone is in bondage, Gulag Archipelago is the supreme example of bondage, where nobody is the least teeniest, weeniest bit free, and yet everybody still has his free agency. Those characters throughout the book, all are people who act on their own free agency, regardless of the fact that they're in total bondage. It's quite a thing. Being free and having free agency are not the same thing at all. Of course, whoever sins is in bondage to sin, as Paul tells us, you're in bondage to sin. The worst sinner in the world, of course, is in terrible bondage. He's not free at all, but he still has his free agency. That's what makes him a sinner. That's why he's responsible. So we'll always have our agency. Nobody take that away from him. But what about this bondage in the 79th verse? It's not right. Well, at the end of the Middle Ages, for example, during the Hundred Years' War, all Europe went into bondage to the nobility, who went into bondage to each other. Literally. They would fight, they would imprison each other for the sole purpose of ransoming each other. Everyone. Everyone was attacking everybody else to hold them. You see, and then when after the Battle of Crecy, when there was no more big-scale fighting to be done, they all broke up into the famous free companies. Famous Sir John Hawkwood, being the most famous of all of his white companies, the free companies that ravaged everywhere, that grabbed everything they could and grabbed from each other. And the result was utter chaos and complete, this horrible, horrible 14th century, the way everything collapsed, which could have been one of the greatest ones. But it is this sort of nonsense, by this kind of economy, that Satan forges his bonds. The dialectical materialism of the communists is an economic system, and this is the way we're told. And our own economic practices are wasting and destroying the world. We do go into bondage this way, but it doesn't deprive us of our agency. But how do we escape such bondage? It tells us in the next verse. For this purpose I've established the Constitution. There wouldn't be such bondage. Not to reward the industrious and punish the idle, but that no man should be in bondage to any other, no matter what his vice. This can't refer to the special provisions in the Constitution, the length of office, the second Tuesday in November, things like that. That is not the law of eternity. The place of elections to be held, whether it's two congressmen or one district and so on and so forth. This refers to the inalienable parts of the basic parts of the Constitution, as Joseph Smith explained very clearly. It's the Bill of Rights, of course, they talked about, that no man may be in bondage to another. I mean, whether the election is held on Tuesday or Monday doesn't make that much difference. Almost all countries in the world hold it on Sunday, of course, if people don't go to work then. normal dream of going to church. But this is, it's the Bill of Rights. This is the thing which is by which the Constitution sets up these barriers to bondage. The freedom, as Oliver Wendell Holmes says, for the falsehood we hate as well as for the truth we love, established by the hands of wise men, whom I have raised up for this very purpose, and redeemed the land by the shedding of blood. That has a rather resounding sound. What does that mean? Well, it's very obviously this. Remember, they were under solemn obligation in government. The leaders of the American Revolution had all taken oaths of allegiance to the king, to George I. And when you break such an oath, when you break an oath of allegiance, what do? How could you redeem yourself after breaking an oath of allegiance and redeem from a crime? By willingness to shed blood. That's it. That's the ultimate proof of good faith, that you were not acting in bad faith. If you were willing to shed your blood, then you were acting in good faith and acting sincerely, and you redeemed yourself from the charge of having broken allegiance and broken a covenant. Okay. Of course, the exact relationship of the covenant, the nature of the covenant, had been disputed ever since the Magna Carta, ever since the proviso that followed after it, and ever since the Long Parliament and all the rest of them, Simon de Montfort. These things had always been, and especially Richard II, these things had always been in dispute, exactly what their rights and how far their allegiance went. So again, how far does your allegiance go? at the Battle of Lützen, Frederick the Great. Here for Fluchtuk Carols, his soldiers started running away at the battle. The shooting was terrible. It was all they couldn't tell. And where are you going here for Fluchtuk Carols? And one of them says, I, Fritzl, nicht von Betrug, verfehrt sein Pfennig, das heute genug. Fred, this is not betrayal. This is not, he says, this is not treason. He says, what are you doing? You're betraying me. You're leaving. Not at all. He says, I've done my 14 cents worth today. The soldier got 14 pennies a day for his work, you see. For 14 pennies, this is enough for today, he says, when the firing was as hot as hell. He got up. There was no thought of betrayal or anything like that. But the idea is, where do you stay in a thing like that? Just exactly where do you draw the line? Well, the land was redeemed. It is redeemed by the shedding of blood. If you're willing to pay that price, you're in the clear. But the Constitution, we're told again, is not self-fulfilling. Of course not. As the work of wise men, it must be sustained by wise men. We mentioned the last time Macaulay's essay on the civil disabilities of the Jews, which he talks about in the 18th century, Scotland, the country with the worst constitution in the world, without any doubt, was the best governed country in the world. And some of the ideal nations of Central Europe who had received from the Enlightened rulers, middle 18th century, had received model constitutions, perfect constitutions, models of justice, were the worst governed countries in the world. It doesn't make any difference, the document. What the document is how the people are, and it's here. Just as we're told in the Book of Mormon, monarchy is the best of governments. Well, of course, you learn this also, Aristotle says the same thing, if the monarch is perfect. But if the monarch isn't, it's the worst of governments. That's it. Famous state about democracy, remember? It's a raft, it can't sink. You always have your feet in the water, you're right in the bottom, but it can't sink at any rate. It's not the best form of government, but it's the in-between one. But inevitably, we're told in the 81st verse, unjust men must come into office. The last work that Plato wrote was called The Laws, his work on the laws. And after all his idealism and all his dialogues and the Republic and all the rest, talking about the perfect and the model and any kind of workable government, he is left with this conclusion. He says, we'll never get a good government. It's impossible. The only thing a wise man can do is to seek a shelter behind the wall from the wind and the dust that's blowing and cultivate his garden the best he can. He thinks, why is this? He says, because naturally, in this world, the persons with the least talent and the least ability are the ones least recognized and need recognition most, and they are the ones that are going to run for office every time. The persons least equipped for office will always be the ones that are after office day and night, and they're the ones that are going to get it, he says. So you're never going to have a good government. The example, the two greatest men that ever ruled anywhere in Greece were Epaminondas in Thebes, who had to be drafted again and again. He was a school teacher in an elementary school, and a flutist of some accomplishment, and that was about it. But every time they were in need, they called upon Epaminondas, and he pulled them out of a hole, and for a time he made Thebes the greatest of all the cities. And the same thing with Pericles. whom, as Thucydides says, the Athenians re-elected 51 times, because he always told them what they most least wanted to hear and most needed to hear. Anyone else they would have thrown out, they knew they could trust Pericles, because he told them what they did not want to hear, but they did need to hear. So they realized that Pericles was able to pull them out too. But that's not the way government goes, as a rule. The person who gets the job is the person who goes after the job with determination, and the less qualified he is, as Plato says, the more determined he is to get the job and the more sure he is to get it. Hence the story of the children of Zion and the unjust judge here. It gives us here. The officials, the woman and the unjust judge. What should she do? The answer is don't give up. Men always ought to pray and not to faint. Never give up while we're in this world. Notice this ninth verse, this 81st verse. For men ought always to pray and not to faint. It's not a good thing. It's not a proper reaction to faint. Never give up. You say keep fighting, keep praying. This is the main thing. That will give you your strength. Now this judge was a regular Willis Ritter. He was a real character. He was no good at all. But he was vanity itself. I once appeared at a number of hearings in Salt Lake as, of all things, an expert witness in a case that Judge Ritter tried, and that character in action you would not be. The first day he started by bringing a large mirror into the court with him, and he set it up on the bench in front of him, and he spent half an hour combing his hair in front of this mirror and primping himself. This was Judge Ritter, you see. This is the kind of guy he was, a real character. He was not a bad sort, but he was just insane, that's all. And for such a man to be a judge, well, to give unlimited power, and he thought he had unlimited power. Remember, he was by far the oldest federal judge ever to sit on the bench. He thought he had unlimited power, and he exercised it, too. Well, but how did the widow score her point with him? By wearing him down. It had nothing to do with justice. She just wore him down, you see. Now these verses, verse 85, let the children of Zion, 86, importune at the feet of the judge. If that doesn't work, then go to the feet of the governor, 87th verse. If that doesn't work, then go to the president, 88th verse. If that doesn't work, then go to the Lord, 89th verse. But only after every other recourse has been tried. You notice you pray and you don't faint and you never give up. You go from one to the other. And finally, your final recourse is to the Lord, because we're trying to make things go on during this time of probation as much as possible on our own. Always use whatever resources you have. Use them. And then call upon me, the Lord says. And he says the time is up here, and we still have to assign. So this is what we do. When the Lord intervenes, it will be in his fury to vex the nation. And did ever a nation have a vexation like the great civil war which was to follow? Ever a nation was vexed. Nothing like that. It was absolutely phenomenal. Well, anyway, we'll give this law.